From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, documents recently obtained by WBUR show a closer relationship than expected between Boston police and ICE. We'll have the latest. Also today, with so many tools to predict the future, why are humans still so short-sighted?
Now, when we do think about the future, we tend to focus on predicting exactly what's next, whether we're using horoscopes or algorithms to do that. But we spend a lot less time imagining all the possibilities the future holds.
We'll hear from Bina Venkatraman, author and incoming editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. And figure skater Adam Rippon on his unlikely journey to Olympic stardom.
I repeated the same mistakes over and over, and it wasn't until I realized that what seemed like disappointments were actually starting points, I was able to use them as the beginning of something else.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Happy hunting. That was one of the messages recently sent by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to Boston Police Sergeant Detective Gregory Gallagher. Gallagher was serving as the BPD's ICE Task Force officer, though he was stripped of that role on Friday after WBUR first reported on this story. The email, which also included a detainer or a request from ICE to hold an individual who would otherwise be free to go, is one of 800 pages of documents recently obtained by WBUR that paint a clearer picture of the relationship between ICE and Boston Police. WBUR's Shannon Dooling has been digging through those documents, and she joins us now. Shannon, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
Shannon, let's start with some context. Can you explain a little more about what these documents are and what your initial impressions are as you're looking through them?
Sure. So we filed a public records request 7 months ago looking for more information about a so-called joint ICE-BPD task force. This came up in a federal lawsuit that was filed here in Boston earlier this year. And what we received included email exchanges between the BPD's designated ICE task force officer, whom you mentioned, Sergeant Detective Gregory Gallagher, and a number of federal immigration officials. Now, some of this communication is about people who BPD have arrested on charges like shoplifting and trespassing, low-level misdemeanor charges. In one of the exchanges, an ICE officer asks Gallagher if he can get more info about a woman who has several Boston larceny charges against her. And the ICE officer suspects that this woman is a student visa overstay and wants the names of the woman's parents. And so the next day, Gallagher replies with a copy of a booking sheet and writes in the email that the names of the parents are on that booking sheet. And so that, I mean, that is one example of some of the communication that we came to see in these email exchanges.
I mentioned that Gallagher was removed from his task force position on Friday after you first reported on this. And we do know that Mayor Marty Walsh has said the story sparked a lot of questions. What else have you heard from the mayor's office, Shannon?
Right. Lots of questions. In fact, it's interesting because, you know, we were providing the mayor's office and BPD Commissioner William Gross with a lot of this information for the first time. They weren't familiar with these email exchanges that we had asked them about. They weren't familiar about a formal understanding that the BPD and ICE have on the record. And so we know that Walsh, over the weekend, did, in fact, like you said, strip Gallagher of some of these duties. We don't know at this point what his plan is other than to look into that relationship farther. Let's hear a little bit from Walsh about exactly his reaction to some of the news that that we broke on Friday.
We're going to take a look, evaluate that spot and the relationship to make sure the relationship that we intended to have is to make sure that we're looking for serious criminals.
And so obviously that's the message that Walsh has been pretty adamant about since President Trump took office, and we've sort of heard more about fear in the immigrant community. Walsh has been really adamant about wanting this to be a safe city for immigrants.
As you say, he has been adamant. He's made a lot of comments on the record, Shannon. How does what you found compare to what he said in the past regarding Boston's immigration enforcement policies?
Right. I mean, that's really been my biggest takeaway from the communications that we came to review, is that there really is this clear flow of information between BPD in the form of this conduit, Sergeant Gallagher, and federal immigration officials. And so, you know, what we're looking for at this point is what are the sort of next steps that that Walsh is going to take? It's interesting. Let's take a listen, actually, to some of an interview that we had with Walsh back in March, when all of this news about the Joint ICE BPD Task Force was first coming into play. Let's hear from him from March.
You know, I made it perfectly clear, Boston Police Department officers, they're not ICE officials. Our job should not be enforcing immigration laws for the federal government. If they want to come in and enforce federal law, let them come in and enforce federal law. It's not our job.
But, Tiziana, within a month of Walsh telling us that BPD are not ICE officials, these same emails that we've been discussing were flowing back and forth between Gallagher and ICE.
So, Shannon, we've talked on this show before about the City's Trust Act, which basically prohibited Boston police from holding individuals solely at ICE's request. How does that fit into what you've been finding?
Right. So that original Trust Act, some cities refer to it as a sanctuary city policy, but in Boston it's called the Trust Act. That was passed unanimously by the city council in 2014. Walsh signed it right away. And it's an ordinance that essentially is supposed to outline guidance around how and when BPD should be interacting with ICE. And now the strength of that ordinance has come under a lot of fire this year. It came into question earlier when Gallagher was cited in that same federal lawsuit I mentioned at the top. He was involved in the ICE arrest of a man who at the time of his arrest was in the country without authorization. He filed a workers' comp claim, and his lawyers feared that his construction company retaliated against him. And so during a Boston City Council hearing in April, councilors Josh Zakim and Lydia Edwards, citing the details revealed in that Department of Labor lawsuit, questioned whether the city needed to revisit the teeth, if you will, that are established by the Trust Act, how strong it is. And in June, Walsh and Zakim filed new proposed language, but it hasn't gone up for a vote yet to the City Council.
Shannon, what about other agencies around Massachusetts? Have you learned anything about their involvement with ICE from these emails and documents?
Yeah. Well, and looking through these 800 plus pages of records, we learned that these HSI ICE task force officers, again, these designated task force officers, are working throughout New England, though we don't know just yet to what extent each officer is working in their, you know, respective agencies. But according to the documents, there are at least 30 people with that designation. So they are local law enforcement who are trained and certified with federal customs officer authorizations. And on that list, we saw an MBTA transit officer listed as a task force officer. We also saw a sergeant from the Bristol County Sheriff's Office. Now, the Bristol County Sheriff did just get back to me right before I joined you, Tiziana, and told me that their assigned task force officer has been holding those duties as the ICE task force officer since 2013. We've never heard about this before until we took a look at these documents. And they, at Bristol County Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Thomas Hodgson, says he has no intention of stripping that task force officer of any of his federal duties and, of course, values the relationship that his employees have with ICE. But we're going to be asking a lot more questions about all those other positions as time goes on.
So, Shannon, this is a good chance to take a step back. I want to look at the bigger picture here. We just talked on Radio Boston on Friday about the dust-up at the Harvard Crimson, where some students were upset that the paper reached out to ICE for comment on a story about an anti-ICE protest, their concern being that the Crimson was calling ICE's attention to the protest and students involved, including at least one self-acclaimed dreamer. We also have an ongoing legal fight over ICE's practices of arresting immigrants at or around courthouses. Two Massachusetts district attorneys are plaintiffs against ICE in that suit. So does what you found add any fuel to the argument that ICE is using these kind of backdoor channels to enforce immigration laws?
Well, obviously, there is a lot going on in this sphere right now. A lot of conversations happening about the involvement of ICE in federal law, let alone local law enforcement. So I think I'd say what we've found shows an established pattern of communication between federal immigration officials and Boston PD, again, with Gallagher providing that clear conduit. We know that the existence of these emails and, in fact, the existence of the memorandum of understanding between the BPD and ICE, as I mentioned, that all came as a surprise to both the mayor and Boston PD Commissioner William Gross when we mentioned these details to both of them last week. And we know that much of the communication we've reviewed runs counter to the mayor's message, that his public guidance on the relationship between BPD and ICE. Whether it adds fuel to any fire about disagreements around ICE and the way the agencies cooperate, I think it certainly raises more questions, and we're going to be following this to see how local agencies react.
Okay, Shannon, and last question, very briefly, do we have any reason to believe that ICE has done anything illegal or outside its authority?
No, not based on my review of these documents anyway. I mean, they have, like I said, this agreement was on the books. And what's, you know, in question now is basically how this aligns with Walsh's guidance to BPD and the Trust Act.
That is WBUR Shannon Dooling. Shannon, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We also have in studio WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. It's for another story, but I have to.
Oh,
I can't resist, because Judge Gertner, as you were listening to that, you shook your head like a dozen times. So let me just ask you.
Last time I come in studio for
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Do you have an initial reaction to this that you would like to share?
Well, there are rules with respect to the kind of information sharing that the federal government can oblige a state to do to help them in the enforcement of the immigration laws. The question is whether or not the Boston police are going beyond that, and it sounds like they are. And so then the question is, the going beyond part is up to Mayor Walsh to effect. He can certainly say to the Boston police, you have to do what you're obliged by law to do, which is, I think, to provide certain kinds of names of people who are, I think, involved in more violent offenses, but certainly not to be an investigative arm of ICE. And it's really up to him to stop that and shut that down.
See, this is why we have a legal analyst. We can ask these questions and catch her by surprise when we do so. All right, so let's shift gears to the story that you're actually here for. Mm-hmm. A former Boston College student is being indicted on a charge of involuntary manslaughter for her role in her boyfriend's suicide. Prosecutors say 21-year-old In Young Yu physically and psychologically abused her boyfriend, Alexander Ertula, over the course of their 18-month relationship. Here's Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins speaking at a press conference earlier today.
We have a barrage of a complete and utter attack on this man's very will and conscience and psyche by an individual to the tune of 47,000 text messages in the 2 months leading up, and an awareness, we would argue, of his frail state at that point.
Now, Ertula jumped from the roof of a parking garage and died the morning of May 20th, the day he was set to graduate. D.A. Rollins says there are clear differences between this case and the high-profile manslaughter conviction of Michelle Carter, who the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court found guilty of causing the death of her boyfriend, Conrad Roy. And I should note, Judge Gertner, you have been serving on Michelle Carter's defense team.
That's right.
As the case is being appealed to the U.S.
Right.
Supreme Court.
Right.
So are you surprised by the D.A.'s decision to prosecute this case as involuntary manslaughter?
Yes, for a number of reasons. So, first of all, if there were instances of physical assault over the course of a year, That is an independent crime. The question is the link between the question, which is a troubling and complicated one, is the link between those assaults and those texts and his decision to jump off the roof. Suicide is a complicated psychological phenomenon. And one of the things that we grappled with in the Carter case was there's sort of a continuum of conduct here. On the one hand is the person who hands the potentially suicidal person the loaded gun. That's one end of the continuum. The other end of the continuum is the Carter case, where it was really just talk, and she was 50 miles away when he committed suicide. Even the handing of the loaded gun case is a complicated one, because suicide is a, quote, voluntary act. And the proof has to be that someone, that but for that event, the person would have not committed suicide. So there are lots of questions to ask, even in a situation, whereas here, the defendant is standing next to the young man who commits suicide. What are the questions?
So,
Did he try to commit suicide before?
Which we don't know at this point.
We don't know. That's right, because the best predictor of suicide is prior suicide attempts. I'm not impressed. I don't know enough about the numbers of text messages. Anyone who has teenagers knows that. That doesn't seem to me to be an extraordinary amount.
So let me just clarify for our listeners. In the press conference today, D.A. Rollins noted that there were more than 70,000 texts between the deceased and the defendant over a two-month period, and that 47,000 approximately of those texts came from In Young You. That does come out to about 800 texts a day. That is a lot.
It is a lot, but I would want to look at it in context. Again, I can only you're looking at this through the lens of the Carter case. While the press only reported the texts that seemed to be encouraging suicide, there were also many that said, "Conrad, get help." And so the question is, what are these texts in context? But the bottom line here is that this is a fraught and complex area, and most states have chosen to deal with it through statutes. And the statutes say, here are the circumstances under which assisting another person's suicide is criminal.
And we don't have such a statute.
We don't have that.
We
basically shoehorn this into, you know, a common law 500-year-old involuntary manslaughter charge, which means then it's subject to whether the prosecutor thinks that it qualifies as involuntary manslaughter. It becomes exactly what the criminal law shouldn't be, which is unpredictable.
So, Judge Gertner, to the layperson, I think one would think that there seems like a very big difference between assisted suicide and involuntary manslaughter around the concept of intent. So is it fair to put something like this in the assisted suicide continuum, given the wide variety of possible intent we could be talking about here?
Well, but assisted suicide means only that you have taken acts to facilitate someone else's suicide. Where there are statutes, typically they say, you know, facilitating in terms of providing the instrumentality, the weapon. The statutes that have said encourage have been held unconstitutional.
So let's go back to this, the parallel with the Michelle Carter case, because Rollins actually made a distinction between this case and the Michelle Carter case at the press conference today.
There are similarities in that the culprit are both the girlfriends in those circumstances. But where I would distinguish, and I think the facts will show, in Carter there was very limited physical contact prior and some very egregious language in the moments leading up to the death. We have, quite frankly, I would say the opposite of that.
And of course, when she says the opposite of that, again, she talked about a pattern of behavior in the 2 months prior to Ertula's suicide. Does proximity of activities or even the person in question at the time of someone's death matter from a legal
physical
standpoint?
Physical presence makes this case, the BC student case, a more complicated case. There's no question about it, because physical presence at the time of the suicide arguably creates obligations to do something.
And In Young Yu was allegedly on the top of the parking structure at the time of the
suicide.
Right.
I'm less impressed by the text leading up to that, because as I said, I wanted to look at all of them. I'd want to understand what the full context would be. In the Michelle Carter case, what was most stunning is that while the press kept on talking about how she said, get back in the truck, encouraging him to commit suicide by a text, as it turns out, that was never shown to be a contemporaneous statement. It was a statement that was made by Carter 2 months after the suicide, describing what had gone on in a rambling email. So what is said here is really critical. But the bottom line is suicide is complicated. Don't do this through involuntary manslaughter, which has virtually no specific content. Do it through legislation that we can then address and tell people exactly what's wrong and right.
Let's step back and look at the domestic violence dimension of this, because as we know, D.A. Rollins specifically said that In Young Yoo used physical violence as well as psychological abuse in the months leading up to Ertula's suicide. She said something particularly interesting about domestic violence in her press conference today.
Domestic violence is not perpetrated by one type of abuser. A perpetrator is not limited by their gender or the gender of their partner. Domestic violence may not always look the same, but it is always about power and control.
So setting aside the Carter case entirely, could this particular case have any broader effect on how we deal with other domestic violence cases?
Well, it does, but you have to, again, look at what's interesting about this is if there was violence in the months leading up to the suicide, D.A. Rollins could prosecute this woman for that violence. The question here is linking what had gone on before the suicide with a suicide. That's the problem. Most domestic violence cases are cases in which you prosecute the person for having hit someone.
And that's what
ought to be done here.
So physical violence is one piece. Psychological violence, historically in prosecutions, can one be prosecuted for psychological violence as well as physical violence?
It depends. I mean, it really depends on what the psychological violence is. It would be, it could be verbal harassment, I suppose, but that... That usually is prosecuted civilly through injunctions that sort of do not, you know, essentially to keep out injunctions. We reserve the criminal law for very specific things. And here the specific thing would be if she physically assaulted her boyfriend. That's the analogy, and that's what we do. Suicide has multiple causes, and that may be the step too far in this case.
Okay. So I want to talk now about the school for just a moment. Now, I was faculty at BC actually at the time of this suicide. I remember when it happened. It happened on BC commencement day. They were both BC students. Does the school have any legal concerns here?
The school has civil concerns, yes. The school has civil concerns to the extent that they knew about this kind of behavior. The school has...
Which we don't know.
That's right. The school has, you know, it's called parents patriae, which is school bears a relationship to students, which is the functional equivalent of parents. And so they have an obligation to keep their students safe. It's an obligation that inheres in the tuition payments and the contracts that a college has with its students to keep them safe. And so it seems to me they have affirmative obligations here, but they're civil obligations. Nobody is criminally liable under these circumstances.
Okay, that is WBUR legal analyst, retired federal judge, and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, thank you.
Thank you.
And listeners, if you or someone you know may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's 1-800-273-8255 or 1-800-273-TALK. Or you can text the crisis line at 741-741. Stay with us. I'm Tisiana Deering. There's more ahead. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. Bina Venkatraman was a former senior advisor for climate change innovation in the Obama administration. She teaches at MIT, and she's the future editorial page editor for the Boston Globe starting in November. Venkatraman thinks a lot about the future and believes that we as individuals, organizations, societies don't. Her new book is The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Bina joins me now. Bina, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
You say that we are in a reckless age, Bina. What's different about today? Have there been eras of recklessness in the past kind of seems like we're kind of a reckless species. So what would be different today?
Well, people alive today are living a lot longer than our predecessors and our grandparents, for example. And we have a lot more knowledge and ability to shape the future at scale. So if you think about problems like climate change, where we are putting emissions in the atmosphere today that will shape the climate of centuries from now, or if you think about our knowledge of the half-life of our nuclear radioactive waste, we know more. We see more warning signs about how we affect the future. We know more about how long we're going to live and what we can expect. And so we're not. I talk in the Optimist Telescope, I write about Pompeii and how the ancient residents of Pompeii had no idea that Mount Vesuvius was about to blow and destroy their civilization. Well, we have that kind of knowledge. And so recklessness, I think, it requires you to have a sense of the warning signs. If not, you're just unfortunate.
Okay, so I guess part of what I'm wondering is, to what extent is our inability to respond to that information or to make better long-term decisions something that I don't want to say that we can be faulted for versus not faulted for, but almost sort of species-level involuntary evolutionary behavior versus voluntary myopic, we could change this kind of behavior?
Well, one of the most interesting discoveries in my process of researching the Optimist Telescope over 5 years, talking to scientists from all kinds of disciplines, including biology, psychology, anthropology, the sort of history of the origin of the species, was that it in fact is not a curse of human nature. We are not condemned to being short-sighted in all circumstances. It's certainly hard for us to think ahead. It's much easier to focus on what's right in front of us because we smell that donut on the counter. We can see it.
There is no donut on this counter and I can still smell it. So,
right.
Yes.
You can summon that because it's visceral and it's colorful and it's in your experience, in fact, to have eaten a donut, I would imagine. And so
regularly.
You know what it's like to conjure that. But to conjure an unimaginable future, a future that you haven't yet experienced in your mind, something like sea level rise or a change, a slow change in society or a technological change you've never experienced, that's really hard to conjure and it requires a leap of the imagination. But that's not to say it's impossible. And I think it's a dangerous misconception that is permeating our dialogue today, in part because we're so overwhelmed by a lot of what's going on in our politics and on the planet. It's this misconception that we're cursed to being short-sighted and therefore we should just kind of turn it in and accept that we're not going to be able to deal with problems of the future. And in fact, Jonathan Franzen, the novelist, wrote in The New Yorker in September that, you know, we are just too short-sighted as a species and we should accept the climate apocalypse is coming. Well, that, in fact, I think is a convenient way to excuse neglect of our obligations, and it vastly underestimates our potential. We are capable of thinking ahead. And one of the things that helps us to think ahead is to be in groups and environments with set norms, expectations, cultural norms that we share that help us think ahead.
So there's a lot to unpack there. And the first thing that I want to pick up is this word conjuring that you used. Because one of the things that was striking for me in the book, you give examples of everything from virtual reality simulations to watermark markers in Mattapoisett, Massachusetts, that show how high the water got last time it got really bad. So it does seem like you're finding hope, optimism, from the title of your book, in this ability to use both high and low tech to really help people visualize or engage their imaginations in ways that might change how we think about the future.
Absolutely. There are ways to overcome what are our cognitive biases to focus on the present, and it does require us to be specific. And what I found happening in Mattapoisett, which was led, by the way, by a young Eagle Scout, was a project to mark where the waters had flown, where the waters had risen to during past hurricanes, including Hurricane Bob and the historic hurricane of 1938 that we know was very destructive, and to use that as a way to show people in common places that they walk around town, on Main Street, on the golf courses around town, how bad things can get in a future storm so that they might do better at evacuating and sort of heeding the warnings about future storm surges. So these kinds of tools do hold a lot of promise sort of at the individual level for helping us imagine the future better. And at the collective level, there are tools we can use as well to help our imagination. And I write about the Pentagon's war games, for example, which invite people to play specific roles in scenarios in the future, and how that helps to overcome some of the barriers we have to putting ourselves into future scenarios and and I can talk more about that if that's of interest. But often when a scenario seems so awful to contemplate, it seems like doomsday, we have the tendency to say that won't happen, or we hope it won't happen. And so we'll just kind of take it off the shelf. And instead of sort of looking at it and saying, how can we prepare and make this not so bad?
That was actually one of the, excuse me, striking examples from your book, was that there was a police psychologist in 1972 who was charged with running essentially crisis scenarios for the 1972 Olympic Games in Germany. And scenario 21 basically was the terrorist attack on Jewish Israeli athletes that came to fruition, but that the Olympic officials didn't want to grapple with that possible future, so didn't take even the most basic security measures to prevent it.
That's right. And part of the reason they didn't take those measures was that they were sort of trying to correct for the past. So the Munich Olympics in 1972 were the first Olympics that were held in Germany after the 1936 Olympics, over which you'll remember Hitler presided. And the memory of that and the sort of shame of that was very much in the collective psyche of Olympic organizers as well as the German people. And they didn't want these games to be seen as militaristic or morose. They wanted to rebrand the games. In fact, they called them Die Heiteren Spiele, which means the cheerful games in German. And they didn't want to have security officers who were armed at the perimeter of the Olympic fence. And that led to a situation that was very vulnerable for the scenario that this police psychologist, Georg Zibor, predicted, in fact, which was that there would be an attack on Israeli athletes. And of course, it led to the massacre of those athletes. And this, I thought this story was really important to examine from the lens of today and for thinking about scenarios in the future, because we do have this tendency to sanitize what we hope won't happen. And so I looked at some of the tools like role play games and others that allow groups of people to more actively engage with those futures. It's not just painting the scenario of the future. Instead, you're invested in a sort of quasi-fictional scenario where you have to make decisions and be active. And when you activate people's emotions and show them that they have an actual stake in those futures, that it's not just something that's been painted for them, it can actually help overcome some of those barriers.
So, Bina, that example you just gave was a particular, arguably cultural moment in Germany's history. You mentioned earlier in our conversation the role of cultural norms. Another question that comes to mind is, are there cultures, for example, the sort of free market culture of the United States, which may be more driven by the quarterly profit cycle, for example, are there cultures that are more or less prone to the capacity to think long term?
It's hard to paint entire societies with a single brush. So, for example, if you look at the Chinese government, which is autocratic, does a lot of long-term planning, but there's no accountability because there aren't regular elections. It's not a democratic society with a free press. So it's not that you'd say that's a good model for long-term thinking. And if you look at the Chinese stock market, for example, it's very much short-term speculative. So I wouldn't paint whole cultures with particular brushes. That said, subcultures, groups of people that share cultural norms within societies, can in fact be more short-sighted or more able to think ahead. And as you said, corporate America is a great example of where there's a lot of people being driven by very much the near-term stock price, quarterly earnings and profits, and they're sacrificing value for all of us who are pension holders or 401k holders or shareholders in those companies on a routine basis by not putting those resources back into the company to invest in future invention or in growing market share. And that's been really documented well. I found subcultures in professional poker in Las Vegas, where the poker players were really valuing making calculated bets and amassing earnings over time instead of being impulsive, even in the very, you know, sort of instant gratification environment of the casinos of Las Vegas. And so that sort of stood out to me as a culture that could be cultivated within a sort of another dominant culture.
Yeah, I have to admit, if you'd given me a broad list of the subcultures you might have given as examples of great long-term thinking, professional poker players might not have been one I'd have picked off the list. But I saw from the book, I do see your argument there.
Yes. And, you know, this is something that can be used, for example, in hospitals. So I looked at Johns Hopkins Hospital and the way in which they're creating a culture and environment in the hospital to prevent doctors from overprescribing antibiotics. And another really fascinating example of cultural difference comes from the classic marshmallow test, where toddlers are given the choice to eat a treat immediately, like a marshmallow or a donut or a pretzel, or to wait for some indeterminate amount of time for a second treat to appear. And it turns out the subsistence farmers of Cameroon, the Nso community, NSO, to spell it for you, their toddlers pass this test at a rate of something like 70%, which is very high, whereas German and American toddlers typically pass the test at rates of something like 30 to 40%.
So there's a big cultural difference
there. Big difference, and not something you would expect, right? You would think in poverty and scarcity, there might be more desire to just take as many treats as you can get right away. But there's something there happening culturally.
So we only have about a minute left, and I don't want to lose that minute without at least asking you one question about journalism, getting, you know, given your new role at the Boston Globe. Does journalism have its own problem with foresight? Or do we report in a way that allows for long-term thinking?
Well, I think we have a big responsibility at the moment in particular where we are drinking from the fire hose collectively when we read the news. There's so much to digest. It's coming at us very quickly in 24/7 news cycles, and the president is making news with his tweets. So we have to, I think, in some ways cover what is news, but also to offer readers and audiences a sense of perspective of what really matters. And a lot of times that incremental noise in the news gets in the way of really pointing to the long-term trends that are most important and where we have the highest stakes for our society, including problems like climate change and inequality and sort of the bigger challenges we face.
That is Bina Venkatraman. She's the incoming editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. She's also a former senior advisor for climate change innovation in the Obama administration and teaches in the program on science, technology, and society at MIT. Her new book is The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Thank you, Bina.
Thanks so much, Tiziana.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Figure skater Adam Rippon had spent nearly 20 years training to get to the U.S. Olympics. He was one of the first openly gay athletes for Team USA to compete at the 2018 Winter Games in Pyeongchang, but only placed 10th in the individual men's competition, which left many in the audience feeling he was cheated, most especially comedian and at-home Olympic commentator Leslie Jones.
How is Adam, like, behind these two people that fail? So, Adam, remember next time when you have your routine, make sure that you stumble a couple of times and run into the wall. And I'm pretty sure you'll walk away with gold.
Luckily for Leslie, Rippon did walk away with one medal, a bronze, from the team event. That Olympics and Rippon's winning performances and personality turned him into a cultural phenomenon. He was in Boston this month and joined us in Studio 3. And he brought along his new book, Beautiful on the Outside, but unfortunately not his Olympic medal.
I should have been wearing the medal. I mean, you have such a nice necklace on that it's the only thing that could compete.
Well, it would have been kind of cool to see, but it also would have gone clink, clink, clink against the table.
Yeah, not good for the audio.
No, exactly. All right, now we are going to talk about your time at the Olympics, but your book is really, it seems to me, about getting there in the first place. Does that seem fair?
Truly. I mean, I wanted to write a book. Now, I might seem a little early at 29 to write a memoir, but I feel like I've lived a lifetime as an athlete. And while I'm ending one chapter of my life, I'm beginning another. And I wanted to share a lot of the stories of how I learned about myself through the process of getting to the Olympics, because I did not get there in the easiest of fashions.
Well, to that point, the first time you skated, you fell and you hated it. So how did you get to the point where you loved it?
I think it was just, I was young. I had this expectation of what it would be. I remember, I write about this in the book where, like, I saw this picture on a popcorn tin that are like always around during Christmas time, where it's this Victorian woman and she's in a long coat and she's wearing a muff. And I was like, I think I need to be that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I go and my mom's like, no, you're not wearing a long coat. You're wearing a ski suit. And I'm like, and what about the muff? She's like, we don't even know where to get one. So I had this vision of what it would be. And I, you know, I didn't get to wear any of those things. But I said, you know what? I'm still going to be great. And I got on the ice. And of course, you know, 5-6 years old, fall down. And it was too much. It was already like I hadn't, it hadn't lived up to what I thought it was going to be. And then when I got a little older, I went to a friend's birthday party and I just had a good time. I had no expectation of what it would be. And I just enjoyed the moment so much and I didn't want to do anything else.
One of the other interesting dimensions about the early part of your skating career is the manager-skater relationship between you and your mom.
Mm-hmm.
So you write in the book, quote, in skating, the parents are essentially the skater's managers, quote, end quote, and that your mom, quote, didn't have Kris Jenner's How to Be a Momager rule book, end quote. And I actually found myself thinking, wait, did she actually write that book?
Is that- No, but she should if she doesn't have a, you know, a bestseller yet.
So this is intense. So first, tell us what it was like to train like that, the intensity of being managed and pushed all the time.
I was the one doing a lot of the pushing. But, you know, I knew that my mom was putting an equal effort of making sure that I was able to skate with the best coaches that we could find and that I had every resource available to me. My mom did everything. On the same token, you know, my mom doesn't have any skating experience, so it's the blind leading the blind. Skating is not one of those sports where you can have promise and talent and you get recruited by a good team. And then you just work with a coach or you get traded to another team. In essence, it's your parent who has no prior knowledge in a sport is making all of these career defining decisions.
It sounds incredibly stressful for both of you.
Of course. And it leads to a lot of frustration sometimes between the parent and the child. And I think, you know, it didn't feel like pressure when I was young, but as I got older, I realized all of the things my mom was doing to make sure that I could go after my dream. She was, you know, sacrificing a lot. And as I got older, that felt like a lot of pressure. And I wanted to do it more on my own so that I wouldn't ever go into an event and feel like I was letting my family down or I had wasted their time and energy.
Now, eventually that led to what feels like in the book is a necessary separation or breakup
mm-hmm.
between you and your mom when it came to your career. She even closed your bank account. I mean, you were on your own.
Mm.
One, what was that like? And was it necessary to sort of be put on your own 2 feet that much?
Totally. And it was exactly what I asked for. It felt harsh, but it's what I asked her to do. You know, my mom and I, we were both frustrated, but I think my mom also felt that, like, if I were to take over and try to do everything on my own with having little to no money, that in essence, I was maybe like throwing away all of the work that I had done. I was putting myself at this disadvantage that she thought maybe I didn't need to be at. It's so hard to be a competitive athlete and have Olympic aspirations, and to do it on your own is almost impossible. And I think my mom was really worried for me. And so she did these things to get my attention. And I kept saying to myself that, no, I need to do it on my own. And, you know, through all of the things that my mom and I had been through, it also kind of felt like I was just leaving her and saying, all right, well, thanks for everything. I got it now. And it's not what I was doing. I was doing this so that I could own what I was doing as an adult, and I could feel proud of the successes that I had, and I could own those disappointments, and they would be my disappointments to get through.
So let's move to some of those successes and disappointments of adulthood. We're fast forwarding. You're 24.
Mm-hmm.
You're skating professionally. It is a tough time. You're not eating healthily. You're consumed by your training. And then a few weeks before nationals, you get sick. And it kind of collapses for you. You skate, as you say, poorly at nationals. You miss your chance to go to the 2014 Olympics. But you get back up. You turned it around after that. Some people would quit. How did you turn it around?
Not immediately. It took about a year to get it together because I just was not in a good place. In 2014, I was 24, and I was trying to qualify for the Olympics at an age that I thought was my last chance. And when it didn't happen, all of a sudden, these dreams that I had just felt like they were falling through my fingers, that I was so close, but then it just never came to be. And I felt defined by those moments of disappointment. I felt like that's who I am.
How did you stop letting those moments define you?
I realized that those moments didn't have to define me. You know, I had nothing to lose. So it wasn't until I realized I had nothing to lose that I could go into situations and be unafraid and just give it 100%. I wasn't afraid of, you know, training too hard. I wasn't afraid of getting injured. What was the worst thing that happened? I would get injured and then I wouldn't be able to compete. Well, it didn't matter. I wasn't competing well anyway. So I trained harder than I ever did. I took risks that I would have never taken. I said things in interviews that I normally wouldn't have said because I, you know, didn't want to come off as, you know, unfocused. But I was being myself and I was working harder than I ever have. And all of a sudden, it just took taking a little bit of a risk on myself and it paid off.
And ironically, once you achieve this moment of authentic, with this place of authenticity, you did get injured and yet you still did compete. You broke your ankle before the next Olympics. Talk about that.
So it was about maybe a year and a month before the Olympics in 2018. I was skating really well. I was a national champion the season before. I just was in the best place that I ever had been. And then I'm warming up, not even on the ice or in my skates, running, just going for a jog, and I twist my ankle and I sprain it very badly and I break my foot. Mm. But I think because of the place that I was in, I saw it as a challenge immediately. And I wasn't defined by not going to the Olympics. I was already so proud of how far I had come. I realized that I had learned all of the lessons that sport are supposed to teach you. They are supposed to teach you to work hard, to treat your competitors and peers the way that you want to be treated. I've had really incredible conversations with people who are Olympians and Olympic champions. And we all go through the same ups and downs. It doesn't matter if you have that medal at home or not.
That comes back, though, again, to this incredible mindset that you seemed to be able to shift yourself into in your mid-20s.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to sound so cheesy, but it feels like you found your champion mindset.
You know, I think our parents tell us things and they tell us to think a certain way sometimes or have a certain mindset, talk to ourselves a certain way. My mom was really careful of that. You know, I'd say, oh, God, I'm so stupid. And my mom would say, your brain is always listening. And I'd be like, okay, shut up, Mom. Please don't say that again. I'm going to die. And, you know, my mom would always be like, you know, write things that you're grateful for. And I wouldn't. And then when we had this separation, I found myself going back to those things. And I actually heard them for the first time. I listened to her say them, but I heard them. And I was utilizing them. And then all of a sudden, I realized that the disappointments I had were actually opportunities to do something. And I repeated the same mistakes over and over. And it wasn't until I realized that those, what seemed like disappointments, were actually starting points.
Interesting.
I was able to use them as the beginning of something else.
So there is a, it's not the focus of the book, but there is a parallel story that emerges in the book, which is about you bringing your gay identity over time into your skating.
Mm-hmm.
You were the first, by a few days, the first openly gay athlete to go to the Winter Olympics. There was another athlete who had competed before, not out, and then the two of you were out together in 2018. Some athletes don't like the role model language put on them. But you stepped into a role model space. Did you do that because you were serving others, or did you do that because it was a necessary part of this authenticity for you, or was there some of both?
I think it's a little bit of who I am. You know, I'm the oldest of six kids, so I feel very often in this big brother role to a lot of my friends. I think in the last few years of my career, I was 28, and kids I was training with, they were 17, 18, 19, 20. So I was 10 years senior to some of the people I was training with. So I felt power in that because, you know, going into competitions, I wasn't the best. You know, I was 10th in the individual competition at the Olympics, but I was a really good skater and a really good competitor, and I was I knew I was an asset to that Olympic team to help our team get a medal. And so I thought about that, and I thought about how, you know, just because I might not walk away with a gold medal, it doesn't make me any less than.
Was that also going through your head while you were competing, this idea of of role modeling and identity. And you just said I placed 10th, but I was a really good skater.
Mm-hmm.
How does that come together in your competition?
Well, it comes together because I realized that when I was representing myself in the best way that I could, I was being the best competitor I could. I was representing my country to the best of my ability. And I also realized that, you know, when I spoke my mind and when I lived in these moments fully and authentically and with honesty, I was also being my best. But I think that I want to share those moments that, you know, where I didn't feel my greatest, I learned from those moments and I was able to really have experiences that I didn't think that I would ever have the opportunity to have.
That's Adam Rippon, former Olympic figure skater. His new book is Beautiful on the Outside, a memoir. Adam, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.